You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, sinkholes are becoming more common, and in the last 6 months alone, they've destroyed cars, trucks, and homes, costing millions of dollars to repair. Our guest shares what's going on underground and how municipalities are responding.
First, the latest numbers on Milwaukee's infant mortality rates show an improvement, but there are still areas of concern, especially when it comes to the gap between the white infant mortality rate and the African-American infant mortality rate.
Dr. Joffrey Swain joins us now. He's the medical director of the City of Milwaukee Health Department and a professor at UW-Madison. Dr. Swain, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
What kind of changes has Milwaukee seen in its infant mortality rates according to the latest fetal infant mortality review?
So we released two reports simultaneously, and one was the fetal infant mortality review, and the other was the report on our most recent infant mortality rates. The rate report just looks at the number of infant deaths and the rate of infant deaths. And the fetal infant mortality review goes into much more detail about the causes of those deaths. So in terms of the rates, what we saw in the most recent year that we have data for, which is 2016, we saw a very low number of infant deaths compared to historical averages in Milwaukee. In fact, we had 88 infant deaths in 2016, which is the second lowest that we've ever recorded. Now, when you convert that into rates, that means that for every 1,000 infants that were born in the three-year period from 2014 to 2016, about nine, actually exactly nine, as it turns out, died during those years. So that's a death rate of nine per thousand, and that's one of our best rates ever. And at the same time, it's still a very high rate compared to other places in other developed countries, for example. And we also saw that we continue to have significant racial disparities in our infant mortality rates. Black infants in Milwaukee in the most recent three-year period were 2.7 times more likely to die than white infants before their first birthday. So that continues a trend that on average has been about a threefold difference for the last close to a decade or more.
And that racial gap in infant mortality rates has been troubling Milwaukee for a while now. There has been, it sounds like, some improvement, though, since the last time.
Well, again, we use three-year rolling averages because they're more statistically stable. The one-year rates and the one-year ratios tend to bounce around quite a bit, and it's kind of like the Labor Department uses a four-week moving average for unemployment rates. Because their weekly job reports is just too unstable statistically. So, yes, you can say that it looks like there was a drop in the racial disparity from our previous report from 2013 to 2015 when the disparity rate was 3.2 to our current report, 2014 through 2016, when it was 2.7. But I wouldn't put too much stock in that right now. I don't know that that's a trend that is guaranteed to continue in a positive direction, because for the previous 9 reporting periods, racial disparity ratio was slowly stepping up each one of those years. So this is really unusual. And in fact, part of what might be behind the drop in the gap, the racial gap, is that during 2014 to 2016, as compared to the previous three-year period, the white rate actually went up, which, of course, is not how we want to go about resolving the racial disparity.
If we can step back in time for a minute, I was surprised to read that before 2004, Milwaukee had one of the lowest infant mortality rates in the country. Can you give us a quick snapshot of what's happened since then for African Americans?
Before 2004... our infant mortality rates overall in the city ranged between from 1997 through about 2005 range between 11 and 12 infant deaths per 1,000 live births. Now, when you look at that historically for Milwaukee, that's, you know, that's one of the best periods that we've ever had. The several decades before that, going back to the mid-1970s, the rates were typically between 11.5 and 13 per 1,000 live births. And then before the mid-70s, they were much higher. In fact, back in the late 60s and early 70s, we had as many as 20 deaths per 1,000 live births in a given time period in Milwaukee. So there are a lot of factors that that go into that, and I can talk about them more. But I think the main point here is that starting in the second half of the 2000s, when the Great Recession hit, what we noticed in terms of our infant mortality rates was that the black rate started to creep back up, and the white rate basically remained stable or slightly improving, and so the racial disparity got worse. And certainly these there are many reasons behind that, but one of them could be that the economic downturn, while it hit everybody very hard, especially hit our most vulnerable populations the hardest.
We're talking right now with Dr. Joffrey Swain, medical director of the City of Milwaukee Health Department and a professor at UW-Madison. And we're talking about the latest in infant mortality rates in Milwaukee. And Dr. Swain, what do we know about what's behind the racial gap when it comes to infant mortality rates in Milwaukee?
So to get into what's behind the racial gap in infant mortality rates, and not just in Milwaukee, but actually pretty much anywhere in the country, you first have to understand the primary causes of infant deaths. And that's what our fetal infant mortality review report gets into. And our most recent report looked at a four-year period from 2012 through 2015, and we looked very closely at the circumstances surrounding each infant death and analyze them for causes and for additional risk factors. And when you look at that, during that time period, what we can see is that the primary cause of infant death in Milwaukee is complications of prematurity, babies being born too small and too soon. And that was the main driver of death in over 55% of our infant deaths during that period. That's by far the biggest cause. The second most common cause of infants dying before their first birthday in Milwaukee is birth defects, so congenital anomalies, heart defects, genetic problems, that sort of thing. About 21% of infants that died in Milwaukee during that period had that as their primary cause. And then the third biggest factor is unsafe sleep-related conditions, accidental suffocation, SIDS, et cetera, and that's about 16% of our infant deaths overall as far as a primary cause. So when you see that prematurity is by far and away the number one cause of infant death, then you can start to understand some of the reasons that might be behind the racial differences in infant deaths, because there are significant racial differences in preterm birth rates. In Milwaukee, blacks are about twice as likely to have a preterm birth as whites. I believe it's somewhere around 16 to 18% of African American births are premature in Milwaukee, compared to about 8 or 9% of white births. And then I can talk more about why that might be, but the first thing I want your listeners to understand is that is not an issue of genetics. That is an issue of environmental stressors.
So when we look at the environmental stressors, it sounds like that could be implicated in higher rates of preterm births for African-American babies. What did you find?
So there are a number of mechanisms by which chronic stress gets under the skin and causes people to be sick in general, and causes pregnant women in particular to be more at risk for a preterm birth. And of course, everybody has stress, But some people have more resources to be able to manage or mitigate that stress. And on average, people with lower educational attainment, people who have lower incomes, and people of color, among other groups, more vulnerable groups, have higher levels of chronic stress. And when you have this chronic unmitigated stress, you have chronic elevations of certain stress hormones in your body, particularly cortisol and adrenaline. And these hormones cause physiologic changes in the body. And for pregnant women in particular, they disrupt glucose metabolism, so they make it more a woman more at risk to have diabetes during pregnancy, which is a risk for infant death. And they make it more likely for a woman to have high blood pressure during pregnancy, another risk for infant death. And especially they disrupt the blood flow to the placenta, which makes it more likely that the infant will, as it's growing, will not receive adequate oxygen and nutrients. And most of all, what adrenaline in particular does is it makes a uterus more irritable. The muscle of the uterus becomes more irritable, and it really increases significantly the risk that a woman will start in labor, begin contractions far too soon. And so these are the ways that chronic stress, unmitigated stress, gets under people's skin and really increases the risk for preterm birth and infant death.
So we're low on time, but I want to ask you one final question. How do you have success at lowering this racial gap for infant mortality with African-American women and their babies if you haven't solved or you're having trouble solving problems of poverty and systemic racism? Where do you go from there?
Well, I think that the key things to working on addressing the racial gap are the same things that are important to working on reducing infant mortality and preterm birth for everyone. And those are three main categories of things. The first has to do with improving individual behavior. So women need to get prenatal care as soon as they know they're pregnant. Pregnant women shouldn't smoke. Anyone in a household with a pregnant woman shouldn't smoke. Safe sleep is important. Babies should sleep in their own crib without soft objects or stuffed animals or pillows, et cetera. And so those are the kind of individual behavior category. The next has to do with healthcare access and quality healthcare. What we find is that too often women who have had a previous preterm birth or who have a chronic illness like high blood pressure or diabetes do not get adequately managed and treated during their pregnancy, and that increases their risk. And then the third thing is these life course stressors. So we have to do things at a policy level, collectively, as a community, as a society, to make life less chronically stressful for all of us. So that means improving opportunities for employment. It means providing additional programs that provide social support and social cohesion. We need to make sure that healthy food is affordable and available in all neighborhoods. We need to support educational attainment and especially early childhood education. So there are many, many things that we can do. This is a very complex problem, but it is not insolvable. It just means that lots of things have to be addressed simultaneously.
And we leave it there. Dr. Swain, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Joffrey Swain, medical director of the City of Milwaukee Health Department and a professor at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at the latest infant mortality rates in Milwaukee, and you can read an article on those latest numbers on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we hear why sinkholes are opening up in surprising areas and costing millions of dollars to repair each year. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Congressional Budget Office reports that nearly 23 million more people could be uninsured in the next decade if the GOP's health care bill is signed into law. Learn more in just a bit.
First, during campaign seasons, it's common to hear lawmakers from both sides of the aisle talk about investing in our crumbling infrastructure. It can seem like a cliche, but our next guest reports that as our below-ground infrastructure ages, it's becoming more common to see our roadways literally crumble.
Sinkholes are occurring more often in busy urban areas and costing municipalities millions of dollars each year to repair. Ranging in size from a pothole to a football field, Cave-ins can swallow up cars, semi-trucks, and even houses.
Roger Schneider joins us now. He's a news editor with the Associated Press based in Detroit, and he's been reporting on the increase in sinkholes. Roger, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, good afternoon.
Well, Roger, you write that sinkholes are not a new issue, but it seems like that they're occurring more often than they used to. What's changing?
Well, when you talk about sinkholes and how often they occur, you often hear about the ones in Florida, where there's probably a sinkhole every day, all the time down there, and that's basically because of the geology of Florida is such that it's got a lot of limestone and moving water that tends to make things collapse. So in Florida, you can have collapses, sinkholes, just about anywhere. But now they're starting, the same people that are studying sinkholes in Florida have noticed just this uptick in sinkholes in places where they don't have that kind of geology, and it's occurring in many cases in the as a result of this underground infrastructure, some of which is 50, 100 years old in many cities around the country.
Now, the word sinkhole, it's pretty descriptive of what the actual thing is, but can you just walk us through what a sinkhole is?
Sure. As I said, some people will dispute that what's happening are sinkholes because of the geological definition of a sinkhole, as in the case of Florida. But essentially, it's the same thing. It's a collapsing of the earth or whatever is above. And many of these pipelines that are getting old are built under roadways. So often what's happening now is there's water, there's a break in some kind of a line. It's sending out water in just like it would naturally in Florida, and it's sending out water, and this is causing the roadways to collapse underneath them.
How dangerous are sinkholes?
Well, they can be very dangerous. One of the things that I found out, I hadn't realized when I started looking into this, was right after there was a sinkhole in Fraser, Michigan, which obviously was part of my territory that we cover here as a news editor for Associated Press. I started looking around and discovered that just earlier in the month of December, there was a sinkhole in San Antonio, Texas, where a sewer line had erupted. And the road gave way, and it was at night. It was early December, in kind of a remote area of San Antonio. And a woman driving home from work, an off-duty deputy, drove into the sinkhole, which was filled with water. It was 12 feet deep, and she drowned in it.
Mm. And in terms of the places that might be most vulnerable, you said it used to be Florida and the unique aspects of that area there, but what is happening? What are we seeing, especially in urban areas now, that's happening not just in Florida but across the country?
Well, the infrastructure is getting old and it's cracking. The one in Fraser, Michigan, happened on Christmas Eve, 6 o'clock in the morning. One of the residents whose house had to be destroyed because of this heard cracking. They called the fire department. And they told them to get out of the house immediately. They were one of three houses that had to be destroyed after they were condemned. So what's happening is in that case, they still don't know what caused the line to break. It is under a road. It was about a 44-year-old pipeline, so it wasn't even one of the older ones. But they may never know for sure what caused it to break, but it did break. It was probably a period of a little heavy rain as well, so there was a lot of water running through, and the road just collapsed. And this was a pretty good sized collapse. It was the size of a football field. Mm. And they're going to be working on that until the end of the year to fix that.
Is there a way to determine areas that might be at risk for sinkholes, or do you know that you have one when it appears, when you got one?
Well, that's one of the things. They're underground. With these kind of sinkholes, I just want to distinguish between this and the ones that are in Florida. No one can predict a sinkhole even in Florida, except that they will happen because of the geology there. Now, in the case of the infrastructure, Fraser, Michigan, where this sinkhole occurred, they're doing a complete test of their sewer line now as a result of this. And since that collapse occurred back in December, they discovered another crack nearby that they essentially said was a sinkhole waiting to happen. But other than doing very thorough inspections, there's really no way to know what's vulnerable.
And how much does it cost? If we've got all this aging infrastructure out there, how do we afford to repair all of these aging water and sewer lines?
Well, it is expensive, and the American Society of Civil Engineers, they come out with reports every few years on the costs of doing this, and essentially it's getting farther and farther behind because nothing's being done. They estimate that the cost, the difference between what's being spent and what should be spent was about $55 billion. In 2010, and that's going to rise to about $110 billion by 2025.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Roger, President Trump announced his budget requests recently, and they include $1 trillion of infrastructure spending over the next decade, a lot of that coming from assumed private investment. Do you see hope there to modernize our roads and also what's underneath them?
Well, I think the difficult thing with all that, and I think what engineers are concerned about, the ones that I talked to for my story that I did, was that a lot of the talk is always about roads and bridges. People drive on those. They get upset by potholes that they run across and crumbling bridges. But you don't see these underground lines. There has been obviously a lot of attention in the past couple of years now because of what occurred in, for instance, Flint, Michigan, with the water lines that they have and are replacing there. But still, it's when it's out of sight, it's out of mind to a lot of people, and there's not a lot of specifics yet as to what the money is going to be spent on. But
and we leave it there. Roger Schneider with us, news editor for the Detroit Bureau of the Associated Press, with us to talk about why sinkholes are becoming more costly and more common.
Coming up, we'll look at the Congressional Budget Office's score on the GOP's American Health Care Act. This is Central Time. You are listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. A young girl enters a school talent show. A boy learns some family secrets when his mom returns from a trip to India. And an online shopping session goes wrong. Those stories and more tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, nearly 23 million fewer people in the United States would have health insurance over the next decade if the GOP's health insurance legislation passes in the Senate.
That's the assessment from the Congressional Budget Office, which released its score of the American Health Care Act yesterday.
Donna Friedsam joins us now for more. She's a researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. Donna, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
What is your takeaway, big picture, from this Congressional Budget Office report on the American Health Care Act?
Well, the report is not terribly surprising. It affirms pretty much the same findings that had come out in March based on the previous iteration of the American Health Care Act. We knew then that there was going to be coverage losses based on changes to the Affordable Care Act, and the previous estimate was a reduction in insured of about 24 million people, and the current report is 23 million. And a large amount of that reduction comes from Medicaid. And so we really don't see a lot of difference. The details of how those changes come about and all the conversations we've been having in the last several weeks about high-risk pools and pre-existing conditions, those are things we can get into that might make a difference for different populations. But the bottom lines haven't changed a whole lot, even with the changes to the bill.
Now, talking about that 23 million number, it means that, as I understand, in 10 years, 23 million fewer people would have coverage as compared to what would happen by then under the current system. It doesn't mean 23 million people who have coverage today will lose it after the passage of the act. Is that right?
Correct. The estimate is that there will be 23 million more uninsured than under current law.
And you said the big part of that came out of Medicaid changes. What would change there? Who would be taken off of coverage under Medicaid?
So within those 23 million, the estimate is that 14 million of them would be people losing Medicaid coverage. And that comes from, in part, a little more than half of that comes from the provision in the Affordable Care Act that allowed for states to expand their Medicaid coverage for adults that had previously not had that coverage. So a number of states, 32 states, including the District of Columbia, had expanded their coverage and received a very high percentage of federal matching funds to expand. And so under this, under the AHCA, that federal support for those expansions would be ended. And so the expectation is that the states would not have the wherewithal to continue supporting that expanded coverage. Now, in Wisconsin, people are likely aware that we did not, in our state, participate in the ACA's Medicaid expansion. We did expand for some low-income adults without the not using the ACA Medicaid expansion. And so we wouldn't be directly affected by that. However, there are some other very substantial changes under the Medicaid program in this new bill under the AHCA that affects all states. And I can continue and go into details there if you'd like to know. So the AHCA has provisions that really substantially change the Medicaid program nationally. So the way it's currently structured is that we in our state get about, we have a matching rate, so it's about 59% federal money to 41% state money. And no matter how much we spend in our Medicaid program, we're going to get that federal match for our expenditures. Now, there are some details in the match changes for certain specific populations and programs, but that's the basic story. And so if more people come onto the program, if the expenses get higher, et cetera, we're always going to get that federal match, no matter how much it costs the federal government. This program under the AHCA changes that, so it essentially caps the amount of federal contribution. And so it will turn it to what's called a per capita cap, or at the state can ask for a block grant, which would be just a set amount of money, or a per capita cap would be a specific amount of money per individual person. And that would be set at the 2016 rate of spending for the state. So they would look at what our state is currently spending in 2016, and then it would increase at just a consistent rate tied to the Consumer Price Index medical component, which is historically much lower than what we might expect from an increase in Medicaid expenditures over time. So if that change does come to pass, there will be a growing difference between what the federal government is giving us to run our Medicaid program and what it's costing states to run our Medicaid program.
And I want to jump in there, because this is a time when the economy is doing pretty well, employment's looking pretty good. Could we find a situation where we set our fixed amount from the federal government at this pretty happy place, the economy turns down in a few years, more people need coverage, and we're still getting the same amount of money?
Well, and this is a big concern around a block grant, where the federal government says you just get this fixed amount of money overall, and that fixed amount of money doesn't change no matter how many people you have enrolled in the program. What a per capita cap model does is it says, for the sake of simplicity, it'll say we're going to give, the federal government will give us $1,000 per each individual enrolled. So we could, in theory, increase the number of people enrolled in the program, but still only get that $1,000 per individual. So it will fluctuate based on the total numbers enrolled if it's a per capita cap as opposed to a straight block grant. I know this is getting a little complicated to understand, but it does provide that degree of flexibility. The big concern that still remains, though, is that the amount doesn't increase even under a per capita cap in a way that would be consistent with what we might expect to increase in a Medicaid program. And even, yes, in economic downturns that are where we might have outbreaks of certain diseases or conditions. So if and when that does happen, the state is going to be left with expenses that we'll have to figure out how to cover in other ways. And the ways that a state can reduce their expenses in the Medicaid program are to reduce payments to providers or reduce the benefit package for people enrolled or as you noted, reduce the number of people eligible for the program or somehow find efficiencies in the healthcare system by changing the way the healthcare system operates. But it's not easy to find those savings.
Talking to Donna Friedsam from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, looking at the American Healthcare Act, the Republican Congressional Plan, new score from the Congressional Budget Office. Donna, we focused a lot on Medicaid so far. When people think of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, I think they think of the individual marketplace where people can go onto healthcare.gov. What changes in that, and how would that affect, according to this report, how many people are covered?
So I'm going to speak in Wisconsin numbers specifically, since that's our state. And the American Healthcare Act substantially changes the federal subsidies that are tax credits that are available for people who purchase their insurance individually, not getting it through their employers. So under the, and I'll use the term Obamacare, which I use interchangeably with the ACA, but under the ACA or Obamacare, currently people get a federal tax subsidy depending on their income. So it's a larger subsidy if they're lower income, and it's a smaller subsidy as their income increases. And the subsidy disappears if their income is more than four times the federal poverty level. And the AHCA changes the structure of that subsidy, so and reduces the subsidy quite significantly overall. And with that, what we would see is many fewer people being eligible for the subsidy, but also more. Less subsidy for lower income people and more of a subsidy perhaps for people with a little bit more income. And overall, we'd see a reduction in enrollment in the individual market because of a belief that it would be less affordable overall to people. So some projections that have come out just over the last few days suggest that overall enrollment over 10 years in the individual market in Wisconsin would decline by about 130,000 people, which is one-third, or more than one-third of our total enrollment in the individual market today.
We're talking about the American Healthcare Act, the plan passed in the U.S. House, still on hold in the U.S. Senate. Donna Friedsam with us from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the score on the American Healthcare Act? Do you think that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, should be repealed, or should we maybe keep it around, maybe with improvements? And what do you think of the new Republican plan for healthcare? Do you like it? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the Republican American Healthcare Act and the score it received yesterday from the Congressional Budget Office. Donna Friedsam is with us, researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute.
And you can join our conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the American Healthcare Act? You can give us a call now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Donna, we've talked about raw coverage numbers so far, but a lot of people concerned about the quality of coverage, what kind of care is included in the coverage, and then, of course, premiums and out-of-pocket costs. What kind of things do we see changing there?
The AACA contemplates the idea that if we remove regulations from insurance, people can get the kind of insurance that they want and not buy things that they don't want or need. And so the idea there, in theory, is that young, healthy people only need to buy very light coverage, or what some people call skinny policies. And so they will get insurance policies that don't cost very much, and that will bring them more into the insurance market, and so more younger, healthy people will enroll. And we see that in the CBO estimates, that they show more younger, healthier people may indeed come into the market. So they will have lower premiums, but they will also have much higher deductibles and co-payments, because their policies will not be very substantial. On the other side of that, though, is because you don't have a lot of young, healthy people sharing in the costs of comprehensive coverage, the policies that do have comprehensive coverage become very expensive. And so people who need to have comprehensive coverage, and that generally becomes older people or even middle-aged to older people, those policies become much more expensive, and the premiums get higher for that group of people. You heard over the last few weeks a lot of discussion about concern for people, for example, with pre-existing conditions and what might happen with those people. Now, let me say the AHCA does retain the Obamacare provisions that protect coverage for pre-existing conditions, but it does allow states to waive those provisions so that in that states can choose to let insurance providers price their policies based on an individual's health status, and they can eliminate the what's called the essential health benefits package, or what's basically a floor in the coverage that insurance providers must provide, the kind of package they must provide. So if states were to do that, then we would see what I just described, where there would be these kind of skinny benefit packages that would attract younger, healthy people at a very low premium, but possibly high deductibles and co-payments. But we would see much higher premiums for people who had health needs, and possibly and very likely people with pre-existing conditions getting priced out of that market entirely. And that leads to that discussion about, would there be high-risk pools being set up to move people with high-risk or pre-existing conditions entirely out of the regular insurance market and into their own pool? And whether that would be a potential solution, that is something that is a premise for the AHCA. There's some funding available for states to, in fact, set up these high-risk pools in order to try to take care of people with pre-existing conditions. A great concern is that the amount of funds that are made available in the AHCA seem to be much lower than what most analyses suggest would be needed to handle the health care needs of people with pre-existing conditions.
I want to bring on a caller now. We've got Jeremy on the line in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not a big fan of the new proposal, and I'm not a big fan of the Obamacare, because we keep dancing around the core purpose or reason why we pay high health care costs is that we're not looking at the facilitators, the doctors, the liability insurance premiums that doctors have to pay, the excessive health care for a simple checkup. They do extra things that they don't really need to do just to cover themselves. We need to start looking at the facilitators and stop beating up on the insurance companies completely. We need to look at, again, the doctors and what we're really paying for and why we're paying so much for it.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Jeremy's saying, hey, we need to tackle the costs if we're going to bring down the cost of health care.
I think Jeremy makes a great point. Health insurance costs a lot because health care costs a lot. And we do have a lot of excessive costs in our health care system. some of it is due to inappropriate utilization, like he mentions, and that we do have a lot of waste in our system, and we also have a lot of efficiencies that we need to find, and a lot of it, quite honestly, is excessive pricing. So we need to look at that and try to address that. And there's, I don't think he'd have any argument there from most people who are looking at how to solve these great problems we have in healthcare policy. At the same time, we have tens of millions of uninsured people nationally, and in Wisconsin we still have 300,000 uninsured people and people who need coverage and care today. So while we're trying to work on this issue of costs, we still need to figure out how to get people the care they need today, and that's why we have this great conversation here in Wisconsin and nationally about how do we do that while we also address these costs.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to David with us in Ironwood, Michigan. David, hi.
Yes, I think they should just make insurance insurance. If we buy the same plan, I think it should be the same price. Unfortunately, if we went to any insurance company and pick up the same plan, well, heck, I had leukemia and stuff, and maybe you're healthy, you know, my insurance rates would be a lot higher. But, you know, you say, why should I pay for a sick person? Well, tomorrow you might be that sick person. I mean, up till the point I got my leukemia, I was good health. All of a sudden, I had leukemia. Now I'm, you know, high risk. It's just, you know. And it also affects my employability. I have two associate's degrees. And they, oh, yeah. And then come medical exam, and they find some way, well, we're not hiring now or whatever.
David, thanks for calling, and good luck to you. Donna, that's the problem we're trying to deal with here, the different health care costs and thus insurance costs for people in different health situations.
Well, David made the point that it was exactly what underlied a lot of the structure of the Obamacare. They were trying to create a system where everybody shared in the risk, recognizing that at any point anybody could be sick, and that, you know, insurance pools are about pooling risk. So if we want to pool risk broadly and get healthy people and sick people and young people and old people to share risk across the population, then that is what is called community rating. But when that happens, then you do have younger, healthier people paying higher premiums in order to subsidize the care for older or sicker people. And that's something that became a challenging conversation in this country over the last couple of years, when some people who had previously had perhaps less rich coverage, who felt like they were younger or healthier, or they had less rich coverage and for the moment didn't feel like they needed anything more, started seeing their health insurance policies changed or canceled in favor of Obamacare compliant policies, and they said, why do I have to buy this? So that became a political problem.
Donna, as we start to wrap up, Republicans are saying, okay, maybe these some people lose coverage, but the current system is unsustainable as it currently is. Is there something to that?
Well, you know, we've heard a lot about risks, death spirals and the like, but the data that we have today suggests that the Affordable Care Act and the insurance markets are and would be stable going forward. There certainly are some fixes that need to happen to the law. There are some states, indeed, where the insurers are pulling out of the market for various reasons. There could be some fixes there. But there are many states where the ACA is working very well, Wisconsin actually being one of them. We had 15 insurance carriers in the ACA marketplace over the last open enrollment period, and we have about 230,000 people that chose Obamacare policies over the last period. So I think most analyses by actuarial firms and the like suggest, no, that it is not collapsing on its own. However, I will note that given the uncertainty that's developed over the last several months and the potential threat at the federal level that the federal government won't pay for the cost-sharing reductions for eligible people.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Donna Friedsam from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute looking at the Republican American Healthcare Act.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, an orchestra conductor tells us how listening can make us better listeners and leaders, and how we can be better listeners ourselves.
That and tomorrow's edition of Food Friday, barbecuing. It's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.